where the courts granted the authority to overrule Congress and the President? The answer is that the Supreme Court has simply taken such power for itself. Nowhere in the Constitution is the federal judiciary expressly given the authority to interject itself into every facet of federal and state operation. Federal courts have accumulated their power under the rubric of judicial review. Judicial review involves a court overturning an act of Congress or of the executive branch on the grounds that the act in question contravenes the federal Constitution. It is founded on the principle that courts will be unbiased guardians of the clear meaning of the Constitution. At the time of the Constitutional Convention in 1787, there were only a handful of instances in which state courts overruled legislatures for violating state constitutions. Moreover, state courts did not assume carte blanche authority to rule on any subject. The courts followed British common law. They ruled on criminal law, matters of equity between individuals and businesses, and other legal matters. Courts also, as a rule, regarded the state constitutions as the central legal nervous system of their respective states. Because the constitution of a state had been adopted by the people, generally through a convention and/or direct popular vote, it was considered by judges to be a higher law than an act of a legislature or a state governor. The Virginia Constitution of 1776 even included a statement of principles, that all power of suspending laws or the execution of laws by any authority without consent of the representatives of the people is injurious to their rights and ought not to be exercised. There was no mechanism in the Articles of Confederation, the forerunner to the Constitution, for the sort of sweeping judicial authority later assumed by federal courts. The Articles, in fact, did not establish a permanent federal judiciary, but relied on state courts to resolve disputes. Most delegates at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 thought a federal court system was necessary, that the federal judiciary should be independent of, and not subordinate to, the other branches of government. That principle was affirmed in nearly every state constitution, and that federal judges should serve during good behavior, or essentially for life. These state constitutions aimed to insulate judges from political pressure, but every state constitution explicitly allowed judges to be impeached as a check on misbehavior. In other words, judges were expected to be accountable to the Constitution and the people who approved it. The first mention of the judiciary in the Virginia Plan, which served as the initial outline for the Constitutional Convention, was to make it part of a council of revision that would examine acts of the national legislature and approve or reject them, though Congress could pass a bill over the council's veto. Beyond its role in the Council of Revision, the Virginia Plan had the federal judiciary consisting of a supreme tribunal and inferior tribunals as designated by the legislature. The inferior tribunals would be arbiters of fact, while the supreme tribunal would be the final court of appeal. The jurisdiction for the judiciary was also specific. All piracies and felonies on the high seas, captures from an enemy, cases in which foreigners or citizens of other states applying to such jurisdictions may be interested, or which respect the collection of the national revenue, impeachments of any national officers, and questions which may involve national peace and harmony. Within days of the Constitutional Convention beginning its work, on June 4, 1787, the delegates took up the question of the court's participation in a council of revision, and there was substantial opposition to it. Few delegates spoke in favor of the concept, and there were many questions about the judiciary maintaining its objectivity if it were involved in negating legislative acts. The convention had its most focused exchange on the topic of judicial authority on August 15, 1787. Again, taking up the issue of the judicial veto over acts of Congress, the debate began when James Madison moved that all acts before they become laws should be submitted both to the executive and supreme judiciary departments, that if either of these should object, 2/3 of each house, if both object, 3/4 of each house, should be necessary to overrule the objections and give to the acts the force of law. Charles Pinckney of South Carolina opposed the interference of the judges in the legislative business. It will involve them in parties and give a previous tincture to their opinions. John Dickinson of Delaware argued that judges should not be empowered to overturn acts of the national legislature. Roger Sherman of Connecticut disapproved of judges meddling in politics and parties. The framers considered and rejected the inclusion of the judiciary in the review process. They did not want judges involved in either the legislative process, with all the political intrigue that would entail, or in reviewing laws they would eventually have to adjudicate. Hugh Williamson, a delegate from North Carolina, noted that he preferred to give the power to the president alone, rather than admitting the judges into the business of legislation. Ultimately, the convention came up with the presidential veto. Most important, the framers did not intend to grant general authority to the judiciary to rule on the constitutionality of legislative acts. Madison, who by August 27th had dropped his initial support for the judiciary being involved in a veto, summed up the convention's take on judicial review. He doubted whether it was not going too far to extend the jurisdiction of the court generally to cases arising under the Constitution, and whether it ought not to be limited to cases of a judiciary nature. The right of expounding the Constitution in cases not of this nature ought not to be given to that department. In the final analysis, if the framers had wanted to empower the judiciary with a legislative veto, they could have done so. They did not. Instead, the convention crafted a federal judiciary, like many other provisions in the final Constitution, as a product of compromise. It was a compromise between the interests of the individual states and the need for a federal government that would be strong enough and flexible enough to meet the present and future needs of a nation with diverse interests. It was also the clear intention of the framers that no one branch would be subsumed by any other. Once the convention completed its work, the political battle began over the proposed Constitution. The Federalist Papers, authored by Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay, were among the first and the best post-Revolutionary War examples of American campaign literature. They are a series of 85 essays that began appearing in New York newspapers a little more than a month after the Constitutional Convention ended, on September 17, 1787. Written to persuade members of Congress and the states to adopt the Constitution. Essays 78 to 83, all written by Hamilton, contain the principal discussions of the nature and authority of the new federal judiciary. Because there was no federal judiciary in existence at that time, and the principal concern was protecting the judiciary from being subsumed by the seemingly more powerful executive and legislative branches, much of the debate centered on creating an independent judiciary, rather than in limiting the scope and authority of federal judges. It is for this reason that much of Hamilton's effort in Federalist 78 was dedicated to an explanation of the steps taken by the framers of the new Constitution to ensure that federal judges would be independent and free of control from Congress, the President, the political whims of the day, and the various state governments. The judiciary did not represent a threat, Hamilton wrote, so long as the judiciary remains truly distinct from both the legislature and the executive. For I agree that there is no liberty if the power of judging be not separated from the legislative and executive powers. This is exactly what has happened, but in reverse. Instead of being subsumed by Congress or the President, the judiciary has subsumed substantial authority over the other branches. While other issues garnered most of the attention in the ratification process, there were commentators on both sides of the debate who addressed the nature and potential problems that could develop in the federal judiciary. Unquestionably, spokesmen such as Hamilton, Madison, and Jay were very persuasive as pro-Constitution voices. But there were also forceful opponents of the Constitution who saw the potential abuses. Robert Yates, an ardent anti-federalist and delegate to the Constitutional Convention from New York, was an especially articulate opponent of the Constitution. In a series of essays published in the New York Journal, which became known as the Anti-Federalist Papers, Yates wrote under the name Brutus. In Essay 11, Yates questioned the powers and pitfalls of the proposed federal judicial system. He warned that the real effect of this system of government will therefore be brought home to the feelings of the people through the medium of the judicial power. It is, moreover, of great importance to examine with care the nature and extent of the judicial power, because those who are to be vested with it are to be placed in a situation altogether unprecedented in a free country. They are to be rendered totally independent, both of the people and the legislature, both with respect to their offices and salaries. No errors they may commit can be corrected by any power above them, if any such power there be, nor can they be removed from office for making ever so many erroneous adjudications. The only causes for which they can be displaced is conviction of treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors. This part of the plan is so modeled as to authorize the courts not only to carry into execution the powers expressly given, but where these are wanting or ambiguously expressed, to supply what is wanting by their own decisions. Yates also warned that the Supreme Court would not be constrained by the strict language of the Constitution, regardless of the assurances being offered at that time by the pro-Constitution writers. They will give the sense of every article of the Constitution that may from time to time come before them, and in their decisions they will not confine themselves to any fixed or established rules, but will determine according to what appears to them the reason and spirit of the Constitution. The opinions of the Supreme Court, whatever they may be, will have the force of law, because there is no power provided in the Constitution that can correct their errors or control their adjudications. From this court, there is no appeal. And once activist judges found themselves freed from the constraints imposed by the Constitution, Yates predicted, there would be no practicable limit to the court's reach. When the courts will have a precedent before them of a court which extended its jurisdiction in opposition to an act of the legislature, is it not to be expected that they will extend theirs, especially when there is nothing in the Constitution expressly against it, and they are authorized to construe its meaning and are not under any control? This power in the judicial will enable them to mold the government into almost any shape they please. Yates predicted the process by which the federal judiciary would achieve primacy over the state governments and the other branches of the national government. Perhaps nothing could have been better conceived to facilitate the abolition of the state governments than the constitution of the judicial. They will be able to extend the limits of the general government gradually and by insensible degrees, and to accommodate themselves to the temper of the people. Their decisions on the meaning of the Constitution will commonly take place in cases which arise between individuals, with which the public will not be generally acquainted. One adjudication will form a precedent to the next, and this to a following one. While the Constitution created the silhouette of the national judiciary, it was up to the Congress actually to form it with legislation that would constitute a functional system of federal courts. Congress did this with the Judiciary Acts of 1789 and 1801. The biggest problem with the Judiciary Act of 1801 was timing. The bill was introduced before the presidential election of 1800, but was not passed by the Federalist-controlled Congress until after the election. And while the deadlocked presidential election was being determined by the House of Representatives, President John Adams signed the bill on February 13, 1801, just 3 weeks before the end of his term of office. He also sent to the Federalist-controlled Senate nominees for the 16 new judgeships, and they were confirmed shortly before the end of the Adams administration. These judges came to be called Adams' Midnight Judges, some of whom became the subject of the Marbury v. Madison case. On March 8, 1802, just days after Thomas Jefferson's followers, the Republicans, took control of both houses of Congress, Congress repealed the Judiciary Act of 1801. On April 29, 1802, Congress enacted the Judiciary Act of 1802, which, among other things, abolished the 16 new judgeships created by Adams and the Federalists. In its 1803 Marbury v. Madison decision, the Supreme Court determined that it had the power to decide cases about the constitutionality of congressional or executive actions, and, when it deemed they violated the Constitution, overturned them. The shorthand label given to this court-made authority is judicial review. And this, quite literally, is the foundation for the runaway power exercised by the federal courts to this day. What is far less recognized is that Marbury started out as anything but the ominous precedent it has become. Marbury was a brilliantly conceived political strategy crafted by John Marshall, a master politician. Marshall, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, wrote the decision not to set a revolutionary precedent, but to deny the new president, Jefferson, his longtime political rival, an opportunity to rebuff a Supreme Court controlled by Jefferson's Federalist opponents. Marbury was precipitated by the election of 1800, in which Thomas Jefferson, the incumbent vice president and leader of the Republicans, ran for president against the incumbent president, John Adams, leader of the Federalists. The Federalists controlled both houses of Congress, but were torn between the followers of Adams and Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton's faction withheld its support for Adams' re-election bid in 1800, and the race ended in an electoral college tie between Jefferson and his vice presidential running mate, Aaron Burr. Adams came in third. The election was then thrown into the House of Representatives. Realizing he would not win re-election, Adams moved to solidify his party's influence in the federal government. The passage of the Judiciary Act of 1801, creating 16 new federal circuit judgeships, was part of his strategy. Just prior to leaving office, Adams selected and the Federalist-controlled lame duck Senate confirmed nominees to fill the posts. Adams' term ran out, however, before John Marshall, who was then Secretary of State, could actually deliver the commissions of office to some of the designees. Marshall's successor as Secretary of State, James Madison, refused to deliver the commissions at President Jefferson's direction, and William Marbury, among others, filed suit in federal court seeking an order, writ of mandamus, directing Madison to deliver his commission as Justice of the Peace. Marshall, long a rival of Jefferson's in Virginia politics, was one of the most articulate leaders in the Federalist Party. Marshall had served in the Virginia State House, the U.S. House of Representatives, as one of President Adams' representatives to France in 1797, and then as Secretary of State. He was nominated to be Chief Justice by President Adams and assumed the post on February 4, 1801, exactly 1 month before Adams' term ended. With a Republican majority elected to both houses of Congress in 1800, Marshall realized that Jefferson and his Republicans could denude the Supreme Court of authority, and that he, as Chief Justice, could be impeached and removed from office. Marshall understood that in the Marbury case, if he ordered Secretary of State Madison to deliver Marbury's commission to office, Jefferson would order Madison to ignore the Supreme Court's writ, and the court's authority would be seriously weakened. Marshall was also concerned that he not be seen as protecting the interests of Federalist jurists like Marbury, who had assumed his position as a justice of the peace and had been hearing cases and issuing judgments for a year. Bearing all this in mind, Marshall's decision in Marbury, while upsetting the Constitution's balance of power and the relationship between the federal government and the states, was a master political stroke. Marshall stated that Marbury, consistent with legal doctrine at the time, had something akin to a property right to the office to which he had been nominated and confirmed. Marshall also said that the federal judiciary should be able to issue an order directing the appointment of Marbury. But because the Constitution did not enumerate such an original right for the Supreme Court, the court was powerless to do so. Marshall went well beyond the specific issues in the case. He said that the court had a responsibility to set aside acts of Congress that violate principles enumerated in the Constitution. Between these alternatives, there is no middle ground. The Constitution is either a superior, paramount law, unchangeable by ordinary means, or it is on a level with ordinary legislative acts, and like other acts, is alterable when the legislature shall please to alter it. If the former part of the alternative be true, then a legislative act contrary to the Constitution is not law. If the latter part be true, then written constitutions are absurd attempts on the part of the people to limit a power in its own nature illimitable. Certainly, all those who have framed written constitutions contemplate them as forming the fundamental and paramount law of the nation. And consequently, the theory of every such government must be that an act of the legislature repugnant to the Constitution is void. The judicial power of the United States is extended to all cases arising under the Constitution. Could it be the intention of those who gave this power to say that, in using it, the Constitution should not be looked into? That a case arising under the Constitution should be decided without examining the instrument under which it arises? This is too extravagant to be maintained. Marshall's Federalist Party had lost the presidency and Congress, but Marshall was determined to fight back. And so the doctrine of judicial review was born. Yes, the Constitution is indeed the supreme law of the land. But now the court, by its own fiat, would decide what is or is not constitutional. The Constitution's structure, including the balance of power between the three branches, was now broken. Although Jefferson is claimed by modern Democrats as the father of their political party, he was a leading opponent of judicial activism. After Marbury, Jefferson became an even more vocal critic of what he viewed as the overreaching of the judiciary under Marshall's leadership. To Abigail Adams, John Adams' wife, Jefferson wrote a year after Marbury, "The Constitution meant that its coordinate branches should be checks on each other. But the opinion which gives to the judges the right to decide what laws are constitutional and what not only for themselves in their own sphere of action, but for the legislature and executive also in their spheres, would make the judiciary a despotic branch." Jefferson's concern about judicial power grew stronger as he passed into old age. From Monticello in 1820, the author of the Declaration of Independence wrote to William C. Jarvis, "To consider the judges as the ultimate arbiters of all constitutional questions is a very dangerous doctrine indeed, and one which would place us under the despotism of an oligarchy. Our judges are as honest as other men, and not more so. They have, with others, the same passions for party, for power, and the privilege of their corps, and their power the more dangerous as they are in office for life and not responsible, as the other functionaries are, to the elective control. The Constitution has erected no such single tribunal, knowing that to whatever hands confided, with the corruptions of time and party, its members would become despots. It has more wisely made all the departments co-equal and co-sovereign within themselves. Neither the history of our founding nor the establishment of our government supports the current arrangement in which the judiciary rules supreme. Indeed, Marshall's ruling in Marbury was nothing short of a counter-revolution. For 200 years, the elected branches have largely acquiesced to the judiciary's tyranny. Chapter 3. In the Court We Trust? The Constitution was never meant to prevent people from praying. Its declared purpose was to protect their freedom to pray. Ronald Reagan. The First Amendment provides that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The framers thought that religious faith was important to our system of government. They believed in the protection of religious minorities and sought to avoid the intolerance and threat to religious liberty that might arise from a nationally established church. But we've come a long way since the First Amendment was ratified. As Chief Justice William Rehnquist has written, the court bristles with hostility to all things religious in public life. For the last several decades, the court, based on a misreading of Thomas Jefferson's now famous letter to the Danbury Baptists, which we will discuss in due course, has seized on the mistaken idea that the Constitution requires a severe wall of separation between church and state. As a result, the Supreme Court's cases involving the religion clauses are hopelessly complicated and riddled with inconsistent conclusions. But there is one conclusion we can draw. The Supreme Court has simply abolished your right to the free exercise of your religion in public. And unless the courts are called to account on this, religious freedom in this country is seriously endangered. Many of the men who founded America came here to escape religious persecution. And when the Constitution's Bill of Rights was drafted, their goal was to make sure every American maintained his right to practice his faith free from government interference and with no federal favoritism to a particular creed. So the federal government was prohibited from establishing a religion, and equally prohibited from interfering with the people's free expression of their religion. What does it mean to establish a religion? Liberals today believe the government establishes religion if a nativity scene is placed on a town square at Christmas. But the framers had a much different understanding. They had in mind the Church of England, a formal union of political and ecclesiastical authority in the hands of the state. The First Amendment's Establishment Clause, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion," was written to prevent the federal government from establishing a national church. States, however, retained the right to have established churches, and, in fact, several of them did. The Puritans, later the Congregationalists, for instance, were the officially established church in Massachusetts. Not only did many colonies collect taxes for maintaining established churches, religious orthodoxy was upheld as well. When the doctrines of a church were enforced by the state, the results could be quite severe. The punishment and execution of religious heretics continued in the New World in Massachusetts with the expulsion of Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson in the 1630s, and the execution of Mary Dyer and other Quakers in the 1660s. The Quakers found similar treatment at the hands of the Anglicans, the established church in Virginia, where a series of anti-Quaker laws passed in the late 1600s criminalized the refusal of Quakers to baptize their children, prohibited their assembly, and provided for their execution if they returned after expulsion. The nonconformists in the colonies continued to suffer under the established churches during the Revolutionary era and beyond. In Virginia, non-Anglican preachers were required to obtain a license from the state. Baptists refused as a matter of principle, and more than 45 Baptist ministers were jailed for this offense in Virginia between 1765 and 1778. Among the Virginians who took notice of the Baptist suffering was James Madison. As a result, he became one of the strongest advocates of disestablishment. In Connecticut, the union of religious and political interests between the Congregationalists and the Federalists was known as the Standing Order. Professor Daniel L. Dreisbach of American University has written, "All citizens, Congregationalists and dissenters alike, had to pay taxes for the support of the established church. Civil authorities imposed penalties for failure to attend church on Sunday or to observe public fasts and thanksgivings, and positions of influence in public life were reserved for Congregationalists. Dissenters were often denied access to meeting houses, their clergy were not authorized to perform marriages, and dissenting itinerant preachers faced numerous restrictions and harassment by public officials. These religious dissenters, such as the Danbury Baptists, weren't exempted from supporting Connecticut's established church until the Toleration Act of 1784. Against this backdrop, the framers contemplated the role of religion in the new republic. Although the original Constitution did not include a Bill of Rights, in 1789 Congress proposed 12 amendments to the states, 10 of which were ratified in 1791, including the First Amendment with its establishment and free exercise clauses. James Madison, the primary author of the Bill of Rights, believed the intent of the religion clauses to be quite clear. He apprehended the meaning of the words to be that Congress should not establish a religion and enforce the legal observation of it by law, nor compel men to worship God in any manner contrary to their conscience. But neither Madison nor Jefferson, the framers most secular in outlook, were hostile to religion. It was widely believed at the nation's founding that faith was a necessary predicate to liberty. As Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, human beings have certain unalienable rights endowed by God. Rights are not conferred on us by a monarch or the state. Without faith, he later wrote, liberty was vulnerable. And can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God? That they are not violated but with His wrath? Furthermore, Madison wrote near the end of his life that belief in God was essential to the moral order of the world. Opposition to an established church is not opposition to religion in general, though this concept has been completely lost on today's secularists. Madison interpreted the free exercise of religion, according to American Enterprise Institute scholar Vincent Philip Munoz, to mean no privileges and no penalties on account of religion. The Establishment Clause, Munoz writes, was intended to end things like special religious taxes, religious qualifications for public office, and the enforcement of religious orthodoxy through Sabbath-breaking laws. The Establishment Clause was never intended to ban the invocation of God in public forums or the voluntary participation in ceremonies or rites that recognized God. In other words, it was never intended to create a strict wall of separation between church and state, a phrase, of course, that appears nowhere in the Constitution. In fact, Madison noted how avoiding the establishment of one religion had actually helped religion in general. He wrote, "Religion flourishes in greater purity without than with the aid of government." At the time of the ratification of the Constitution, America was an extremely religious nation. The framers never envisioned a time where the mention of God in the public square would be controversial, let alone illegal in certain circumstances. The historical record is filled with examples of officials of the federal government invoking God during the same period that the Bill of Rights was ratified. Chief Justice William Rehnquist has written of one exceptionally persuasive example. On the day after the House of Representatives voted to adopt the form of the First Amendment religion clauses, which was ultimately proposed and ratified, Representative Elias Boudinot proposed a resolution asking President George Washington to issue a Thanksgiving Day proclamation. Boudinot said he could not think of letting the session pass over without offering an opportunity to all citizens of the United States of joining with one voice in returning to Almighty God their sincere thanks for the many blessings he had poured down upon them. Within 2 weeks, President Washington issued the following proclamation. Now, therefore, I do recommend and assign Thursday, the 26th day of November next, to be devoted by the people of these states to the service of that great and glorious being who is the beneficent author of all the good that was, that is, or that will be, that we may then unite in rendering unto him our sincere and humble thanks for his kind care and protection of the people of this country previous to their becoming a nation, for the signal and manifold mercies and the favorable interpositions of his providence in the course and conclusion of the late war, for the great degree of tranquility, union, and plenty which we have since enjoyed, for the peaceable and rational manner in which we have been enabled to establish constitutions of government for our safety and happiness, and particularly the national one now lately instituted, for the civil and religious liberty with which we are blessed, and the means we have of acquiring and diffusing useful knowledge, and in general for all the great and various favors which he has been pleased to confer upon us. And also that we may then unite in most humbly offering our prayers and supplications to the great Lord and Ruler of nations, and beseech him to pardon our national and other transgressions, to enable us all, whether in public or private stations, to perform our several and relative duties properly and punctually, to render our national government a blessing to all the people by constantly being a government of wise, just, and constitutional laws, discreetly and faithfully executed and obeyed, to protect and guide all sovereigns and nations, especially such as have shown kindness to us, and to bless them with good governments, peace, and concord, to promote the knowledge and practice of true religion and virtue, and the increase of science among them and us, and generally to grant unto all mankind such a degree of temporal prosperity as he alone knows to be best. So our first president called for a national prayer to God within days of the vote on the Bill of Rights. Government interference with religion was relatively modest until the 20th century. There were few, if any, significant court decisions regarding the religion clauses of the First Amendment for the first 150 years of the Republic. During this period, the federal government actually provided direct funding to religious organizations. As Rehnquist has noted, as the United States moved from the 18th into the 19th century, Congress appropriated time and again public monies in support of sectarian, religious Indian education carried on by religious organizations. Typical of these was Jefferson's treaty with the Kaskaskia Indians, which provided annual cash support for the tribe's Roman Catholic priest and church. It was not until 1897, when aid for sectarian education for Indians had reached $500,000 annually, that Congress decided thereafter to cease appropriating money for education in sectarian schools. In 1947, however, the Supreme Court upended the long-standing balance between the government and religion in a case called Everson v. Board of Education. Justice Hugo Black, a longtime admirer of Jefferson, revived a previously obscure metaphor from Jefferson's writings. While president, Jefferson had written to a Baptist community in Danbury, Connecticut, which had congratulated him on his election. Jefferson used his letter to explain why he didn't call for national days of fasting and thanksgiving, as George Washington and John Adams, his predecessors in office, had done. Jefferson wrote, "Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legitimate powers of government reach actions only and not opinions. I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. Interestingly, 2 days after writing to the Danbury Baptists, Jefferson attended church services held in the House of Representatives and continued as a regular attendant throughout his presidency. Although the point of the Danbury letter was to explain why he didn't issue proclamations for Thanksgiving and fasting as president, he used virtually indistinguishable language invoking God in other official statements, such as in his annual messages to Congress. But in writing for the court in Everson, Black seized on this idea that a wall of separation existed between church and state. Black also declared that the religion clauses of the First Amendment, which were intended to be a check on the federal government, were now applicable to state and local governments. The term wall of separation was to attach thereafter to every case or controversy arising under the Establishment Clause or the Free Exercise Clause. Everson involved a New Jersey statute that permitted local school districts to create their own rules for transporting children to and from school. The Board of Education for Ewing Township, New Jersey, which relied on public buses, reimbursed parents for their children's fares. A portion of this money was distributed to parents who enrolled their children in Catholic parochial schools. As one would expect, these schools instructed their students in Catholic religious teachings. A taxpayer who lived in Ewing Township brought suit, alleging that the New Jersey statute violated the Establishment Clause. The court, however, disagreed. Justice Hugo Black, delivering the majority opinion, wrote, "New Jersey cannot exclude individual Catholics, Lutherans, Mohammedans, Baptists, Jews, Methodists, nonbelievers, Presbyterians, or the members of any other faith, because of their faith, or lack of it, from receiving the benefits of public welfare legislation. While we do not mean to intimate that a state could not provide transportation only to children attending public schools, we must be careful in protecting the citizens of New Jersey against state-established churches, to be sure that we do not inadvertently prohibit New Jersey from extending its general state law benefits to all its citizens, without regard to their religious belief." While this affirmed fair treatment of religion in the public sphere, other portions of Black's opinion established the anti-religious precedent that has done so much damage to religious freedom. He wrote, "No tax in any amount, large or small, can be levied to support any religious activities or institutions, whatever they may be called, or whatever form they may adopt to teach or practice religion." He added, "The First Amendment has erected a wall between church and state. That wall must be kept high and impregnable. We could not approve the slightest breach." According to his biographer, Roger K. Newman, although Black wrote the majority opinion upholding the use of public funds to transport children to Catholic schools, he did so for the purpose of undercutting the true meaning of the religion clauses. Justice Black's opinion in Everson v. Board of Education drew criticism from all quarters. Black's rhetoric and dicta contrasted too sharply with his conclusion and holding to satisfy anyone. If he had not written it as he did, he later said, Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson would have. "I made it as tight and gave them as little room to maneuver as I could." Justice Black regarded it as going to the verge. His goal, he remarked at the time, was to make it a Pyrrhic victory, and he quoted King Pyrrhus, "One more victory, and I am undone." Black therefore joined the majority in order to thwart them from the inside, and he succeeded. Today, Everson is remembered more for the easily understood wall metaphor than for the fact that state funds were used to reimburse the parents of parochial students. Black might have had darker motives behind his opinion. He had been a member of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s, when the Klan was deeply resentful of the growing influence of Catholicism in the United States. According to Hugo Black, Jr., his father shared the Klan's dislike of the Catholic Church. The Ku Klux Klan and Daddy, so far as I could tell, had one thing in common. He suspected the Catholic Church. He used to read all of Paul Blanchard's books, exposing the power abuse in the Catholic Church. He thought the Pope and the bishops had too much power and property. He resented the fact that rental property owned by the church was not taxed. He felt they got most of their revenue from the poor and did not return enough of it. Whatever the motivation, Everson is an inherently flawed opinion. The implications of Black's absolutist language lead to absurd outcomes. Bruce Fine, a former Associate Deputy Attorney General of the United States, provided this withering critique. On the one hand, Black insisted that the Establishment Clause prohibited government from offering any type of financial or other support to religion, either directly or indirectly. Neither a state nor the federal government can set up a church, whatever form they adopt, to teach or practice religion. Black, however, seemed to sense the absurdity of his categorical prohibition, which would have required public ambulances to deny service to a cleric who suffered a heart attack while preaching from the pulpit. Accordingly, he immediately retreated from his unbending stance, but without saying so. The fallacy of the wall metaphor is plain, but it is still a constant of constitutional law. Such is the power of Supreme Court precedent. In his dissent in the 1985 case Wallace v. Jaffrey, Rehnquist pointed this out again. It is impossible to build sound constitutional doctrine upon a mistaken understanding of constitutional history, expressly freighted with Jefferson's misleading metaphor for nearly 40 years. Thomas Jefferson was, of course, in France at the time the constitutional amendments known as the Bill of Rights were passed by Congress and ratified by the states. His letter to the Danbury Baptist Association was a short note of courtesy, written 14 years after the amendments were passed by Congress. He would seem to any detached observer as a less than ideal source of contemporary history to the meaning of the religion clauses of the First Amendment. Yet liberals constantly rely on Jefferson's words to justify their opposition to virtually any government intersection with religion. For example, Robert Channon, General Counsel for the National Education Association, NEA, explained that the NEA opposed school voucher programs that include religious institutions because if a state can take millions of dollars, hand it over to sectarian schools, which is then used to provide a religious education, it seems to me you've punched a gaping hole in the wall of separation between church and state. Barry Lynn, the executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, criticized the Supreme Court's decision to uphold a school voucher program, saying the Supreme Court has taken a wrecking ball to the wall of separation between church and state. Ralph Neese, president of a group calling itself People for the American Way, complained about politicians campaigning from the pulpit, which clearly violates the spirit of the founders' wall of separation between church and state. These left-wing groups and their leadership are clearly out of the mainstream of American thought and tradition, but their views often resonate in judicial chambers. As Rehnquist has written, the Establishment Clause did not require government neutrality between religion and irreligion, nor did it prohibit the federal government from providing non-discriminatory aid to religion. There is simply no historical foundation for the proposition that the framers intended to build the wall of separation that was constitutionalized in Everson. The wall of separation between church and state is a metaphor based on bad history, a metaphor which has proved useless as a guide to judging. It should be frankly and explicitly abandoned. Despite this, the wall is part of the lexicon of many Supreme Court cases that involve religion, and it has led to an inconsistent and illogical series of decisions. Once again, Justice Rehnquist explained in his 1985 opinion in Wallace v. Jaffrey, "In the 38 years since Everson, our Establishment Clause cases have been neither principled nor unified. Our recent opinions, many of them hopelessly divided pluralities, have with embarrassing candor conceded that the wall of separation is merely a blurred, indistinct, and variable barrier, which is not wholly accurate and can only be dimly perceived. A state may lend to parochial school children geography textbooks that contain maps of the United States, but the state may not lend maps of the United States for use in geography class. A state may lend textbooks on American colonial history, but it may not lend a film on George Washington or a film projector to show it in history class. A state may lend classroom workbooks, but may not lend workbooks in which the parochial school children write, thus rendering them non-reusable. A state may pay for bus transportation to religious schools, but may not pay for bus transportation from the parochial school to the public zoo or natural history museum for a field trip. A state may pay for diagnostic services conducted in the parochial school, but therapeutic services must be given in a different building. Speech and hearing services conducted by the state inside the sectarian school are forbidden, but the state may conduct speech and hearing diagnostic testing inside the sectarian school. Exceptional parochial school students may receive counseling, but it must take place outside of the parochial school, such as in a trailer parked down the street. A state may give cash to a parochial school to pay for the administration of state-written tests and state-ordered reporting services, but it may not provide funds for teacher-prepared tests on secular subjects. Religious instruction may not be given in public school, but the public school may release students during the day for religion classes elsewhere and may enforce attendance at those classes with its truancy laws. It is almost impossible to discern a consistent thread of logic in these cases. This is because the Supreme Court has once again intervened in matters not on sound constitutional grounds, but because it wishes to dictate policy. And in this area of law, lacking a consistent rationale for its decisions, the court is flailing. Having rejected the plain meaning of the religion clauses, it is forced to concoct ever more nuanced arguments to support its rulings. Two recent cases highlight the problem. In 2002, in Zelman v. Simmons-Harris, the Supreme Court ruled that the state of Ohio could provide education vouchers to low-income parents so they could send their children to private, secular, or religious schools. Writing for a 5-4 majority, Rehnquist noted that the Ohio program did not favor one religion over another. The choice was completely up to the parents. In keeping with an unbroken line of decisions rejecting challenges to similar programs, we hold that the program does not offend the Establishment Clause. Still, four of the justices would have overturned the program. Predictably, Justice John Paul Stevens, the most senior and arguably most liberal member of the court, argued, "Whenever we remove a brick from the wall that was designed to separate religion and government, we increase the risk of religious strife and weaken the foundation of our democracy." Only 2 years later, in the 2004 case Locke v. Davey, the Supreme Court ruled that a Washington State scholarship program could specifically bar state scholarship funds to students pursuing a degree in theology. Joshua Davey, who had won such a scholarship, sued the state and argued that its prohibition on religious study violated the free exercise, establishment, and free speech clauses of the First Amendment. The Supreme Court's majority opinion against Davey was written by Rehnquist. On the surface, this seems remarkable, given Rehnquist's grasp of constitutional history and his past opinions. However, it's possible that Rehnquist, seeing that a majority of his fellow justices had lined up against Davey, decided that he would write the decision with the intention of limiting its scope, and therefore its damage to the religion clauses. In any event, Rehnquist wrote, The religion clauses of the First Amendment provide, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. These two clauses are frequently in tension, yet we have long said that there is room for play in the joints between them. In other words, there are some state actions permitted by the Establishment Clause, but not required by the Free Exercise Clause. Under our Establishment Clause precedent, the link between government funds and religious training is broken by the independent and private choice of recipients. As such, there is no doubt that the state could, consistent with the federal Constitution, permit Promise scholars to pursue a degree in devotional theology. Rehnquist reasoned that while the state could provide scholarship funds for a student to major in theology, refusing to do so while funding other majors is neither discriminatory nor violates the First Amendment. The schools, of course, have been a particular battleground in the assault on the free exercise of religion and even mere references to God. The battle started in earnest with the 1962 Supreme Court ruling of Engel v. Vitale, which outlawed state-sponsored prayer in a controversial and dubious decision that was at odds with American history. Over the years, state restrictions on prayer in school have grown more oppressive and ridiculous, as two recent cases help highlight. In 1992, in Lee v. Wiseman, Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote the Supreme Court's majority decision that struck down the long-standing practice by Providence, Rhode Island schools of inviting clergy to give invocations and benedictions at high school graduation ceremonies. Kennedy said that such prayers violated the Establishment Clause and was specifically concerned with the coercive nature of such prayer. Kennedy wrote, "The undeniable fact is that the school district's supervision and control of a high school graduation ceremony places public pressure as well as peer pressure on attending students to stand as a group or at least maintain respectful silence during the invocation and benediction. This pressure, though subtle and indirect, can be as real as any overt compulsion." This absurdity was picked apart by Professor Vincent Philip Munoz in testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. In Lee v. Weissman, the court eliminated non-denominational invocations and benedictions at public school graduations. According to Kennedy, to ask public school children to stand respectfully while others pray psychologically coerces religious practice. In 2000, the court prohibited the Texas tradition of non-denominational prayer before high school football games, because, it said, some fans might feel like outsiders. Thus interpreted, the coercion test secures the right not to feel uncomfortable because of others publicly expressing their religious beliefs. So the non-existent constitutional right not to feel uncomfortable trumped, in the court's logic, the First Amendment's guarantee of the free exercise of religion, which Providence, Rhode Island had exercised for a very long time. A related controversy made national headlines in 2004 when the Supreme Court heard the case of the Elk Grove Unified School District versus Newdow. The question before the court was whether voluntary recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance with the phrase, "Under God," in a public school classroom unlawfully violates the Establishment Clause. Michael Newdow, who brought the case, was ordained in the Universal Life Church, a ministry that espouses the religious philosophy that the true and eternal bonds of righteousness and virtue stem from reason rather than mythology. He now calls himself the head of the First Amendmist Church of True Science. Newdow also has a law degree and is determined to have his beliefs imposed on society through the courts. He told Newsweek magazine that he had the idea to begin his crusade in a checkout line in 1996. After buying some soap, he looked at the change in his hand and saw, "In God We Trust" on it. He thought to himself, "This is offensive. I don't trust in God." He did some legal research and decided that it would be easier to challenge the pledge than the motto on currency. In 1998, he brought a legal